I'll call the Transportation, Finance, and Policy Committee to order, and for the members that are testifying, we start on time and quit early, if it works that way. So we don't have a quorum, but welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Mary Ellis, and I'm Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. And what I had planned today, we have our division directors that make up the transportation portion of our agency with us today. So I thought I would review, just to remind people, the budget that was passed last year for this biennium. And then, as I go through each division, ask the respective division director to come up and give an overview of anything that's new or answer any questions that people would have about their particular division.
That would be great. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, would you like me to start now?
Mm-hmm. You're right. Yes.
The mission of the Department of Public Safety is to protect citizens and communities, prevent, prepare, respond, recover, educate, and enforce, focus on saving lives, providing efficient and effective services, and maintaining the public trust and developing strong partnerships. The Transportation Division, our agency is funded through two different committees in both the House and the Senate. One is Public Safety and one is Transportation. Our Transportation Committee jurisdiction divisions include the Minnesota State Patrol, Driver and Vehicle Services, the Office of Traffic Safety, Administrative and Related Services, Driver and Vehicle Services, and the Office of Pipeline Safety. Our biennial budget in the Transportation Divisions by fund, we have $171,936,000, or 57% of our funding comes from the Trunk Highway Fund. Highway User Tax Distribution makes up 6%, or $19,126,000. Miscellaneous Special Revenue is $98,076,000, or 32%, and the General Fund is $15,918,000, or 5%.
Mr. Ellison, you probably will hit that, but some of your monies come from fines, don't they, too, also, or not?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I didn't hear your question.
Some of your revenue comes from fines? You know, what, arrest and they fine people in court?
Mr. Chair, yes, there is a whole formula for fine distribution.
That isn't broken down in here.
No, that wouldn't be broken down. Those funds would, my understanding is they would go into the general fund and then they would be transferred to us and to other agencies within state government.
Right, yeah.
First of all, we'll talk about the Minnesota State Patrol. Their mission is to protect and serve all people in the state through assistance, education, and enforcement, provide support to allied agencies, and provide for the safe, efficient movement of traffic on Minnesota's roadways. The annual operating budget of the State Patrol is $82,531,000, and they have a staff of 875 full-time, both sworn and non-sworn personnel. For the biennial budget for 2010 and 11, they have $158,578,000 from the Trunk Highway Fund, $184,000 from the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund, and $6,300,000 from the General Fund. And, Mr. Chair, a portion of that $6.3 million would be included in the fines that you referenced. The Minnesota State Patrol services include aviation, capital security, executive protection, the canine program, crash reconstruction, commercial vehicle enforcement, drug recognition experts, DWI enforcement, fleet management, investigative services, public information, the training academy, radio communications, and the special response team. I'm going to ask Major Tuckner to come and provide a few other updates.
Welcome to the committee, Major Tuckner.
Mr. Chair, Michelle Tuckner, Minnesota State Patrol. On behalf of the Minnesota State Patrol and Colonel Mark Danaski, I thank you for the time today to come and speak with you. Colonel Danaski sends his regrets. He's not able to attend, and he's disappointed that he can't be here. I've been asked to speak today on a couple specific topics that I'd like to start off with because they have been subjects that we've been asked about before, and one of those is the subject matter of PSAP consolidation. PSAP consolidation really isn't anything new. It's something that started many, many years ago. Back in 2003, the legislature actually convened a study group to look at PSAP consolidation and setting minimum standards for dispatch centers. It was about that time that the State Patrol also began to explore our options. Over the last 4 to 5 years, through our strategic planning, we've been looking at this and have, in fact, hired a consultant. And the consultant did quite a study, both technically and operationally, about PSAP consolidation for the Minnesota State Patrol. And as a result of that study, he made some recommendations. And the recommendations were that State Patrol, which currently has 10 State Patrol PSAPs, would reduce to 3 State Patrol PSAPs. That is our goal. We have only recently identified the locations of those PSAPs. Over the course of from now till the fall of 2012 is when we will start to proceed with that process. That also ties in with our armor system. The armor system rollout is occurring over that time frame, and the FCC actually will require that we vacate our VHF frequencies. So there's kind of a coming together of all these timings that would work for our PSAP consolidation. If, in fact, we retained all 10 of the State Patrol PSAPs, we would need to do infrastructure improvements with the armor system. And those improvements for each communication center results in about $200,000 to $250,000 per PSAP. So by reducing down to 3 PSAPs, we can gain some capital savings there as well. As a result of the PSAP consolidation, we do not intend to lose any positions. Those jobs will be transitioned to those new PSAPs. And if there were to be any efficiencies that might be gained by the consolidation, those positions would only be eliminated through attrition.
Major.
Yes, sir.
Could I have you come a little closer to the mic?
Yeah, I'm trying to stretch you and maybe come around the corner a little bit here.
Yeah.
Can you hear me better now?
Right.
Okay. The other subject matter that we've been asked to speak briefly on was the specialty plates. We understand that there were a number of specialty plates out there. From a law enforcement perspective, I liked the white and blue license plates many years ago that were plain and simple and easy to read. However, I realize over time we've developed a large pool of specialty plates. Those plates have been approved by the legislature. We respect that. They do make it a bit more difficult to read, but we are able to work with that in the field, and so we recognize that they will continue to exist, and even though they may cause some difficulties, we'll learn to work through that out on the street.
Major, I think another question we have, actually in special plates, I think the department doesn't really recoup everything they have, and we some of the plates have a fee attached which doesn't come to the department or to the patrol. That's correct, I think.
Mr. Chair, I would defer to the Department of Vehicle Services. I know that they deal with the actual fees that are related to those plates. I couldn't really answer the question on what those costs are and if everything is recouped.
Mr. Chair, Pat McCormick, who's Director of Driver and Vehicle Services, is here, and she'll be presenting on her division, and so she'll be able to address that issue.
The big concern, Major, then, is the fact it's an enforcement, to some degree, an enforcement problem.
I don't know that it's a problem. It makes it more difficult.
Right, that one.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Okay. Just a few other things that I'll touch on about the State Patrol. Over the course of the last year and a half or so, we've had 3 security assessments done on the Capitol campus. They were done by the National Guard, the State Auditor, and by the Secret Service. And we've had a series of meetings since that time. We feel very positive about the meetings. We're looking at these 3 assessments, how they come together, what types of changes that we can make that are low cost. We're also identifying the need for standardized emergency plans, so we're developing those as well. We have integrated the communication center from the Capitol Security here to our Metro Communication Center, which provides some redundancy and extra safety measures as well. And we are exploring from a security perspective for the Capitol complex everything from the day-to-day security that you might experience when you're trying to walk out to your vehicle in the evening to everything from an act of terrorism. We're trying to look at the large scope of all the different security issues, and we'll continue to review those programs and put together a plan on how we will address that.
Major, what is your complement? Are you up to complement? Are you still have positions open? Are you filling positions as they retire? Or?
Mr. Chair, are you referring to the State Patrol as a whole, or are you referring to the Capitol Security, sir?
The State Patrol, I'm sorry.
At this time, we don't really, so to speak, have a complement. We kind of live within our budget, but we are at about 575. We do have some vacancies. We will always have vacancies through attrition and retirements. We will not be running a school until 2011. And as we have more of those vacancies and there is more attrition at that time, we will explore running a school of probably 25 to 30 individuals to replace those that we've lost through attrition.
Major, again, I recognize you really don't have a fixed complement, but how does your numbers now compare with what you had five, or I think it's less than what you had actually probably 6 years ago. Is that correct?
I can look at the exact numbers. I do have some statistics here on that. I believe that this number is higher than the last.
That's correct, Major, because we did allow some last session. We allowed an increase.
We had an increase of 40 troopers, so we are actually higher now than we were probably 5 years ago.
But basically, up to that time, you were actually, every year was more work and less people amounted to, I think.
We did have some reduction in staffing, yes, sir. Just a few other things to touch on that sometimes people are asked questions about. We are attempting to be very frugal with our budgets. We're looking at every way that we can to either cut costs or save money. Last year, through revenue recapture, there was an opportunity for about $200,000 of revenue recapture from damage to our squad cars. Last year, we recouped $170,000 of that money. This year, we're exploring some additional ways to recoup all of that funding. That's one of the things that we're spending some time on. We're also buying less squad cars. Last year, we bought 195 squad cars. This year, we'll be buying about 96 squad cars. Squad cars cost about $24,000 to $25,000 apiece, but after we put equipment in them, if we have to put in all new equipment, when we finish completing them, they're about $59,000 a year, or $59,000 a squad.
Major, are all the cars equipped with the remote camera?
Or? They are all equipped with video cameras, sir. Yes, sir, that's correct. In addition to our squad cars, this year, since the first of the year, we have lost five squad cars have been totaled so far this year. Last year we lost approximately 16 squad cars, so we're purchasing less cars and we're losing some cars, but we are running our cars a little longer. We're finding more efficient ways to continue to operate those vehicles. So those are some of the things we're trying to do from a cost savings perspective. I'll be happy to take any questions anyone has. I'm not really sure what everyone might be interested in presenting. Colonel Danaski usually does this, and so I'd be happy to take any questions anyone has.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Major, a few years ago I was caught in a little deal where we were 40 new troopers and we were going to keep the bars open until 2 a.m. The funding from those special licenses was supposed to cover that. Are we still counting that money in here anywhere? And if you can't answer it, that's fine. I'm curious because I still have a scar or two from that whole dust-up.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, we are no longer using that money towards troopers. And let me just turn around and see if our accounting people can verify that. That's correct.
So they're coming out of the regular budget then. Did we finally get 40, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, we did get 40 troopers.
Eventually, okay.
We were able to use some federal funds also to help us with the 40 troopers. The 2 a.m. bar closing fees did not amount to what was hoped it would be, and we are no longer using those funds to pay for trooper salaries.
Mr. Chair, as I recall, that whole idea with the response was completely underwhelming. And I would be curious, not for this committee, but I'd just be curious of what little money we did raise from that, where that ever ended up.
Representative Beard, maybe you could tell the committee, I haven't been there at 2 a.m. Are they still open till 2 a.m.?
Mr. Chairman.
is that still?
I stepped right into that one, I guess, didn't I?
Come on, Chair. Yes.
For the record, we've got it. Anyhow, Ed, before you leave, Major, I believe you were just about complete. I have one question. According to all the activity we've been seeing on TV and the radio with some of the auto dealers, you had a fraud unit, and my understanding is that fraud unit has really done a great job. Could you explain that to the committee.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair, members, in 1998, the legislature created the Vehicle Crimes Task Force. And at that time, we had four troopers assigned to that task force. That did sunset back in 2000, but through attrition over the last 4 to 5 years, that Vehicle Crimes Task Force unit is down to one trooper at this time. However, recently, when the Hecker investigation first started, we received a number of complaints from citizens about not receiving their titles. Driver and Vehicle Services had brought to our attention some issues and concerns, and we did assign that investigator to take a look at that that incident. As a result of that, we determined that it was rather large. We did call back on a temporary status two retired Vehicle Crime Task Force members to work on that investigation, and they, along with a few other personnel with the State Patrol, have been working that investigation for some time, and that is what the result of the Hecker indictment was yesterday.
So basically, it was through the efforts of that that this whole Hecker situation developed. Is that the only one now, or was there another follow-up with another group?
Mr. Chair, we are constantly finding requests and having incidences that need to be investigated, and so there are a number of other investigations that we are carrying on as well, sir.
And if you aren't familiar with it, the Denny Hecker case is a big one.
Yeah.
And that was basically dealt with a lot of monies for the state, too. So. Mm-hmm. Great. Do you have any further comments?
Mr. Chair.
Oh, excuse me, Representative Swales.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question. I know that it was a year ago that the state auditor did the security of the Capitol Complex report, and you said that you are comparing that to other reports that were done by the CIA and the other group. I don't remember which one it was. When I have traveled to other states and I visited state capitals, whether it's in Denver or in Tennessee or Texas, there's always been limited access in terms of doors. There's, in some of these places, there have been metal detectors. But you are talking about maybe some low-cost changes that might be made. You're talking about a quick response system, better communication. But what other things might we expect? Here.
Major?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair and Representative Swales, I will try to speak to that as knowledgeably as I can. When you commented that there were other low-cost savings, restricted access is one of those things that can be done without additional funding. We newly appointed Captain John Mock to our Capitol Security Complex, and he is looking at every angle, every program, every method and way, also exploring, as you stated, how other states manage their Capitol Complex as well. And it isn't just our state capitol, but the entire Capitol Complex that we are looking at. So I don't know the specifics of everything that's being explored, but I think you will see something coming out on that soon. Thank you.
Major, one thing too, security personnel are not licensed peace officers. Do you have a complement of peace officers assigned to the security staff then every day, or how does that work?
Mr. Chair, members, Capitol Security is made up of two licensed uniformed personnel, Captain John Mock and a lieutenant. We do have a number of unlicensed but uniform Capitol Security guards, and then during legislative session we do have our legislative security officers who are typically our retired peace officers. I do not have the exact numbers. I could get those for you if you like.
No, there was a problem one time as far as between the licensed and unlicensed as far as pay. That's not a problem?
I'm not.
Because it's always a problem.
Mr. Chair, I believe those issues have been resolved.
Yeah. One other question always comes up and hasn't been asked. To the executive security, how many patrol are assigned to the executive?
How many, sir?
Yes.
I'm going to be guessing at best, Mr. Chair. I believe with the Capitol residents, I believe we have 8 or 9, but I can confirm that number and get back to you.
There's actually one assigned 24 hours at the residence, isn't there, I believe?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Any further questions? Not. Thank you very much, Major.
Thank you, sir.
And we have a quorum, so has someone looked at the minutes while the next person is coming up? Representative Mason moves the minutes of what was the date? What was February 9th? Any questions or comments? Not the minutes have been moved. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Contrary? The minutes of February 9th are approved.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, moving on, the next area that we're going to talk about is the Office of Traffic Safety, and I have Sheree Marty with me, the director of that office. The vision of the Office of Traffic Safety is to reduce fatalities and serious injuries to zero on Minnesota's roads, and she'll be talking about the excellent progress that we have made in that area in a few minutes. The mission is to create a culture where traffic fatalities are no longer acceptable through the integrated application of education, engineering, enforcement, and emergency trauma services. These efforts will be driven by data, best practices, and research. The Office of Traffic Safety receives an annual appropriation from the Trunk Highway Fund of $435,000, and that's a required match which allows the office to secure federal funds, grants, and one-time monies that annually amount to approximately $28 million. The services that the office offers includes traffic safety outreach, impaired driving prevention, occupant protection, child passenger safety, traffic records and data systems, safe community coalitions, motorcycle safety, programs for teen drivers, underage alcohol prevention, traffic safety research and analysis, crash outcome and data evaluation, fatal analysis record system, and distracted driving. I'm going to let Ms. Marty add some further details to the efforts of the office.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Marty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's very nice to be here. We really have made some tremendous strides in traffic safety. I think all of you have heard that our 2009 fatality numbers and serious injury numbers are looking very good. And we have to say on behalf of the Department of Public Safety, thank you to all of you for your support for some very critical traffic safety legislation that's been passed over the last few years. And I'm going to be just touching on a couple of those. But just to give you a quick recap, in 2009, we are looking at a final fatality number of 407. Excuse me. That's our preliminary number right now. We're looking at perhaps about 420. So we'll know in a couple more months what the ultimate final number is. But that's an 8% drop since 2008. So that's a tremendous gain for Minnesota. And I will just offer that motorcycle fatalities, bicyclists, that's really dropped down significantly. Pedestrians, on the other hand, has gone up just a bit in 2009. So we are concerned about that, and I think primarily the reason is we've got folks that are feeling a little too safe in those crosswalks and recognizing for drivers that every corner is in fact a crosswalk, and too often pedestrians might be overly confident. We're working with the Department of Transportation on measures to educate the public and do more in terms of letting people know how to keep themselves safe as a pedestrian. Also just want to mention Booster Seat. I want to thank you, Mr. Chair, and the committee, and Representative Hortman, for the strong leadership that we had in passing the Booster Seat Bill last year. And just to mention that prior to the Booster Seat Bill passing, only 30% of 4 to 7-year-olds were properly restrained in a booster seat. And although it's too early to tell the impact right now of that bill, but we do know through a survey that was done through the University of Minnesota that 90% of the survey respondents that they talked to, which is about 800 people, knew about the new booster bill law. So I think that's going to go a long ways, because I firmly believe that parents, grandparents, they all want to keep their children safe. And now they know that we've got this bill, and they know the proper measures to keep their children safe. Another huge step forward, of course, was primary seatbelt. And again, a huge thank you to all of you for your support for that critical life-saving legislation. I just want to offer that we believe that the law is having its intended effect. If you look at from the date that this law was not passed but went into effect, June 9th of 2009 through November 2nd of 2009, so that's about 5 months of that bill being in effect, we had a clear reduction in unbelted fatalities. We had 16 fewer unbelted fatalities than we did the same time the year before. And we believe it's because more people are buckling up, evidenced by the survey that was done in August of 2009, which we now have a seatbelt use rate on average around the state of 90.2%, which is up from 87%. So again, the law enforcement efforts coupled with education and the media that we've done on this new law is making a difference, and more people are buckling up, and consequently more people are living. So the other piece that we're very pleased about was the extension of our statewide pilot ignition interlock program that started in 2007, and it was expanded to a statewide pilot in 2009. And I think that that's a natural segue for me to go in and talk just a bit about the governor's proposal on DWI administrative sanctions. Now, I could stop there and take any questions on anything that I've talked about so far, and then I'll give you a preview of the governor's proposal.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, and I don't know if you're getting into distracted driving later in your presentation. I could hold my question or...
No, please.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your efforts in that, and I wanted to see if you had some data on enforcement of primary seatbelt. Do you have any information about the no texting while driving statute, or what's the enforcement of that, and are you seeing any measurable decrease in that activity?
Ms. Marty?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hornstein, what we know about the texting and driving is that it is a law. This law is essentially for parents to have an added tool to communicate to their younger drivers that texting and driving is extremely dangerous, and it's in its own category of risk. Again, just to remind that it's not only texting, but this bill is also about accessing email, accessing the web. It's not just limited to our younger drivers, but to all of us to not be accessing electronic data while driving. What we know about distracted driving is that it is seriously underreported. When someone is pulled over, they're typically not talking and admitting to the officer, I was texting, or I was on my phone, or I was doing something else in my car that was distracting. But what we have learned is that it is a factor in about 24% or a quarter of the crashes, we believe, is contributing because of distracted driving. So texting specifically, in looking at the number of citation data from the courts, in 2008, we had about, when the bill was passed, August 1st of 2008, we had about 84 citations. In 2009, that bumped up to about 350 citations. So I think that that bill and that law isn't about pulling people over. It's about sending a clear message that this is dangerous, and it's giving parents that added leverage to their younger drivers that, you know what, if you do this, you will get pulled over.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. And one final question on this topic. You know, the Secretary of Transportation, Ray LaHood, is kind of on a mission on this.
Yeah.
And so they set up a website about a month ago, distraction.gov, you know, as a way to put out some of the information. Do you have any plans to do a specific campaign like this at the state level? And you know, how many staff people do you have in, under your distracted driving group? What thoughts do you have both about Ray LaHood's efforts, and can those be something similar done here in Minnesota?
Ms. Murphy.
Mr. Chair and members, with respect to distracted driving and Secretary LaHood, his message has been very clear that distracted driving is very dangerous. And I will tell you that all of the messaging, the communication that the Office of Traffic Safety does, we're always giving the message that people need to focus on driving and take that task seriously. So I will say that it's definitely incorporated in all of our messaging. So it's a year-long message. It's not a one-time wave. I will say that our office is committed to trying to have a more structured event on August 1st. I understand that the governor has designated August 1st as Distracted-Free Driving Day. And what we're talking about doing is having some added overtime enforcement on that day. But the reason why that's important is enforcement around one day isn't going to make a huge difference. But where we get leverage is we do a lot of media prior to that day. Again, reminding people before they go into the busy school season and the fall season, this is dangerous. You need to focus on driving, and particularly looking at texting, because that is what younger drivers are doing. So we are planning on giving that education, having the added enforcement, and then following up with additional education and media, letting them know the results of our efforts. We are also going to be having an informational hearing this year, so in your committee, I believe, Representative Hornstein, and so we're looking at, you know, trying to go further in our education efforts with the members of the legislature so that they better understand that this is a serious problem on our roads.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I got two areas I'd like to just chat with Ms. Marty about. One is, Ms. Marty, your comments on crosswalks, pedestrian fatalities, mm-hmm. a little bit ago is of some concern to me. And I'm thinking back to whenever we liberalized crosswalk rules for pedestrians and kind of cranked it down on automobiles, that there was some concern about an example in Florida whenever Florida went with a more pedestrian-friendly crosswalk law. Some of us thought that maybe was just the opposite, that it would do exactly what we apparently heard here, that pedestrians just launch into crosswalks feeling like they have the right of way. And what's the old adage? You can be right, but you can be dead right, I guess. So I just want to, if you want to talk a little bit about that, about what we're going to do with that, and then to my colleagues on the committee, we're going to have a discussion here about complete streets over the next couple of weeks. And I just want us to remember this example, that whenever we start mixing bikes and carts and pedestrians with highway traffic, that we're mixing things that we may want to think carefully about. But if we talk about that, then we'll talk about engineering, which is a little more sterile. But
Ms. Marty?
Mr. Chair and Representative Beard and members, with respect to the pedestrians, I think in working with MnDOT and members of the community about pedestrian safety, one thing that we recognize, it's the unmarked crosswalk. So every corner is, in fact, a crosswalk. But I believe that drivers are looking for the painted lines on the pavement, when in fact that's not true. That's not the only crosswalk. So we're trying to educate the public, and we've been incorporating that into our messaging, our media messaging, which, you know, the fatalities with pedestrians, really, it's a wide range. There's not any one group. You've got young children darting out between cars, and you've got elderly out for a walk that can get hit by a car. So it's really tough to kind of narrow it down to a specific audience, but we believe that our messaging and going further on unmarked crosswalks is important in our efforts.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then on, I think it was Tuesday, we had MnDOT in here talking about towards zero deaths, and they were talking, they showed us the chart with the dramatic improvement. I mean, 400 still, 400 tragedies, mm-hmm. but compared to where we were just a few years ago, this is remarkable improvement. One of the things that I've noticed, and I think that your department may be assisting, is like in the traffic safety research analysis and the crash outcome business, a lot of just small improvements all over the system that are having apparently big impacts in the outcome of traffic accidents, where people might habitually drive off the road instead of spearing themselves as a minor engineering correction has apparently yielded fender benders instead of fatalities. And while you're at it, can you talk about the guardrails in the median? The median
cable barriers
we put up. Have we seen any immediate impact on that? Has that had any impact, do you think?
Ms. Marty?
Mr. Chair and members, well, there's no question, Representative Beard, your message is about the interdisciplinary nature, mm-hmm. and that is what's making the difference. When we look at when the Towards Zero Death program began, which really got us out of our silos, and it integrated engineering, emergency trauma care, education, and enforcement, and brought those disciplines together to the table and said, let's look at the problem together and let's figure out the answers together. That is making a difference, clearly. So we believe and we attribute the success both to the 4E approach as well as the strong legislative support and the laws that we have been able to pass to protect the public. So does that, I would agree with you. With respect to the cable median barriers, there is no question that that has been a tremendous benefit out on the highways, that a car that's, you know, screaming out of control and about to go into the opposing lane is abruptly stopped by that cable medium barrier. And we have a lot of video that shows that the cars that have avoided a very serious, potentially fatal crash as a result of the cable medium barriers. MnDOT, I know, as part of our Toward Zero Death efforts, they're committing a lot of resources to that tool, and it is, without a doubt, saving lives.
Thank you.
Representative Magnus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not necessarily probably a question for Ms. Marty, but maybe Commissioner Allison, or the patrol is still here. I had a gentleman stop in my office yesterday and ask me about traffic violations, and he asked me where the money goes. And, you know, I guess we've never really talked about that too much that I recall, Mr. Chairman, and I know there's all kinds of tickets and the money goes here and there, but just kind of generally an idea of where does the money go, because his concern was he was saying, and I'm hearing this a lot in my district too, an increase in traffic stops, especially with trucks, for example, where they just start going down the list, and pretty soon you're almost going to give them the truck before you get out of there. And so that's, I think it's a valid question. Where does that kind of money go? I know about the seatbelt. It's supposed to cost $25, and it costs like $125 or something like that. That's different.
Representative Magnus, I think we broached a question to the commissioner when he started.
Mm-hmm.
So she said it's going to be picked up by one of the members when they come through.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Magnus, I think the prior question was about the driver's license plate fee. But, you did ask a question about fines and where they go. There is specific designation in statute as to who gets what percent of the fines that are collected. Mm-hmm. And I think Major Tuckner probably has more detail on that than I do.
Hey.
Mr. Chair, members, there's a state statute, and I can address where the fine money goes for tickets written by the State Patrol, but for tickets written by every other agency, there's another formula, and it's not this, but I can speak to ours. And it's a rather lengthy statute. I've actually kind of written a table here, but it's 3/8 of it goes to the general fund. 5/8 of it goes to the trunk highway fund, but the first $600,000 goes to the Minnesota Grade Crossing Safety Account. However, if the person pleads not guilty, it occurs in the municipality, and a prosecutor has to prosecute, then 1/3 of it goes to the county general fund, 1/3 to the city municipality prosecuting it, and then 1/3 to the state general fund. So it's a little complicated. I do know that the language that addresses citations written, weight violation citations on trucks, is then dispersed even a little differently also.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chairman, I didn't want to open up a can of worms, but I just wanted to point this out because obviously I won't be the only one getting calls and letters and emails, and I don't think I am in the legislature because I don't believe we're just targeting my area, but we're seeing quite an increase, and I am getting calls, and this person that stopped in my office yesterday was not from my area, was from way up north, and had concerns about this and had just come in to thank me for some other work I had done with that organization, but brought that question up. And I said, well, I can tell you that talking to my county sheriff, he says, you know, we get very little money for the tickets that we would write out, for example. Mm-hmm. County sheriff or sheriff's deputy writes it. Mm-hmm. We get very little money. So he said, I don't really, you know, push my folks to go fundraising that way. Mm-hmm. But I just wanted to bring it up just to get an idea.
Mr. Chair, Representative,
because I know it's complicated.
Mr. Chair, Representative Magnus, that's correct. It does go back to the Trunk Highway Fund. It does not come directly to the State Patrol, although we are funded from the Trunk Highway Fund.
Thanks.
Thank you. See, you were going to explain the governor's proposal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I know we've taken some time here, and I am sensitive to the time. I do want to be able to give you a quick preview of the governor's initiative. Again, he communicated this today during his State of the State address this morning, and he has embraced a major initiative to strengthen DWI license sanction reform. And my objective is really to touch on the high points. I just want to make a comment that we've been working on this initiative for 21 months, led by the Department of Public Safety, involving over 60 stakeholders, representing MAD, law enforcement, the courts, county attorneys, attorney general's office, probation, treatment services, public defense. So there's been a lot of folks involved, as well as learning from research, looking at what other states are doing, and also learning from our own Ignition Interlock pilot program. So with that, there is a PowerPoint in front of you, and I'm just going to walk through those pages rather quickly. So if you turn to the second page, there are three goals of this legislative proposal. First off is to safeguard public safety by strengthening DWI sanctions and more effectively using technology. This proposal really seeks to keep in step with current technology in combating the scourge of drunken driving in Minnesota. Second goal, to provide a means for DWI offenders to drive with a valid license. We currently have an epidemic of unlicensed, illegal drivers in the state. Each year we have 40,000 convictions of those driving without a legal license. We feel this is a balanced proposal by protecting the public and also providing offenders with an opportunity to really meet their life obligations. And then finally, the goal is to promote successful rehabilitation for those chronic offenders. So those are our three goals. And next, we'll talk about how are we going to meet those goals, which are the core components of this initiative. These are the cornerstones. So first off, requiring DWI offenders to drive a vehicle with ignition interlock or not drive. So this is really a very simple choice. An offender who has been arrested for DWI, they can install ignition interlock, or they can sit out their revocation period and not drive. It's their choice. So we are providing the privilege to drive on ignition interlock, at the same time eliminating the reoccurrence of drunken driving.
Ms. Marty, excuse me. Do you want to ask a question now?
A very short question. Ms. Marty, can you tell us what the cost is of an ignition interlock? And I Representative Magus had a constituent call and was worried about being able to afford it.
And who pays it to, I think? Ms. Marty?
Mr. Chair and Representative Morrow and members, generally the cost on ignition interlock is $100 a month.
So the offender or not the offender, whoever is charged with it, pays that?
Correct.
Does that answer your question?
The second key component is DWI sanctions are enhanced for first-time offenders at 0.15 alcohol concentration level rather than the current 0.20. When we look at alcohol-related crashes, the alcohol concentration of 0.15 and not the current 0.20 is clearly a threshold for increased risk for fatal crashes as well as serious injuries and reoffense. So currently we do enhance at 0.20, and all the data suggests that that should be at 0.15. 40 states have enhanced sanctions for a higher blood alcohol content level, and Minnesota happens to be one of five states which enhancements are triggered at 0.20. The third cornerstone is our proposal restructures reinstatement requirements for chronic DWI offenders. So currently, our requirements are out of step. They're outdated with what we know in terms of how to effectively work with those with chemical health issues. And finally, the proposal capitalizes on the successes learned from our statewide ignition interlock program. We've had that pilot for 2 years, and we have a better understanding of what works. So the next page is a matrix. And I know there's a lot of information, but this is actually quite simple. I'm not going to go through every element of this matrix, but you can see the current system of administrative sanctions in the middle column. And then on the right is the proposed system of sanctions. What I'd like to just offer is that those with ignition interlock have full driving privileges. Those without would have no driving privileges from 6 months to 7 years. So let me just start with the first-time offender. You'll notice on each of the, on the left column, the different number of offenses. On the right is what we're proposing, and we are proposing a short period of no driving privileges after arrest. So for a first-time offender, that would be 15 days. And then for a second-time offender and on, it only jumps to 30 days. You'll also notice that there is a period of full driving privileges with ignition interlock, or if they choose not to have ignition interlock, they would have a period of their license being revoked, no driving. So we've outlined that for you. And you can see as we move down the list, if you go to second time offender, we've jumped that period of time with no driving privileges to 30 days. And we have 2 years of ignition interlock use or 2 years of no driving or revocation. So the choice is theirs. If you continue to turn the page, you've got the repeat, more of the chronic offenders at 3 DWIs and more. What you'll notice here, these are individuals who have a canceled license. They're canceled as inimical to public safety. So for each of these, again, you've got a 30-day period of no driving privileges. But what changes with these chronic DWI offenders is that we will institute a 1-year limited license. So we're giving them partial privileges on ignition interlock for 1 year, and that would enable them to get to work, their AA meetings, treatment, probation, court, medical, the things that they need to do. So we give them that partial privilege for 1 year. Then for the rest of their revocation period, and for a third-time offender, that's for a total of 3 years. They would serve 2 years on ignition interlock with full driving privileges, no limits. And you'll see that we continue that pattern for the fourth and fifth offense. So you have a period of limited license for 1 year, the rest of the time on ignition interlock.
Ms. Marty, if I may cut you off there.
Please.
Not cut you off, but to we could go, I'm sure, all that. But we're going to have the bill before us, so you gave us a general outline.
Yes.
And I appreciate that. Representative Hausman had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just thinking about this population and thinking about what's happening in society today, when I see offenders pay program costs $100 per month, most of the families I know, I just cannot imagine any family that has $100 a month. I mean, I just think the reality out there is people are living kind of hand-to-mouth. There's surely a huge unemployed group, and even others, just given the nature of the economy today, who are literally using their money for housing and food and gas. And, I mean, $100 per month, what happens if they have no money, or if they I'm just sort of bewildered by that. I mean, a lot of people, for example, aren't getting their license renewed again because they don't even have that money.
Those are issues that we'll have when we hear the bill to Representative Hausman. Those are really critical, and I think there are more of them. Just to say that basically I've had individuals that, because they didn't have the money, lost their job and go on welfare, and that's what's happening. So it's unfortunate. But these are the issues that will come up unless you want to address it. And I also have another question for Representative. Did you complete, Representative?
It was just that one. I just think that's a kind of big practical barrier.
Ms. Marty?
Mr. Chair and members, just to mention briefly that we are looking at, in certifying our vendors, that we would have a vendor-managed indigent opportunity so that the vendors would be charging the non-indigent members a small fee each month, $10. And that $10 would be managed by that vendor, and then it would help to pay and subsidize the cost by 50% for those that don't have the full ability to pay.
Well, for some it would be $110 a month?
What we're anticipating is $100 is going to cover that that additional $10. So it's rough. It's the average, because every vendor is going to their fee might be just a bit different. So on average, it's $100 a month, and we expect that that would cover the $10 for non-indigent.
In other words, Ms. Marty, the vendor gets the pay. The state don't get the $100. It's
correct.
A vendor. It's a
this
franchise.
Is a vendor-managed opportunity.
It's a franchise. Representative Hausman? No. Representative Hortman?
My question is just a quick question. I know for this committee, the civil driving privileges issue is the issue that we'll deal with. I wonder if there's a part of this, the governor's proposal, that deals with the criminal side of it and increased sentencing at any level of the offenses, or if the DWI proposal just relates to the civil privileges of driving.
Ms. Marty.
Yeah. Mr. Chair and Representative Hortman, it is only to deal with the civil side.
Yeah. That's the opposite.
No further questions. Does that complete your testimony, Ms. Marty?
There were some benefits on the final slide, and I probably don't need to go through those, but they're strong, and take a look. Thank you.
I think, too, one thing, Ms. Marty, the one thing that, unless you've had one, and I don't mean I've had one, but the total cost, the way the system is now, for a DWI third time is over $20,000, I believe. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, members, the total cost of any DWI is roughly, even for your first, can be up to $20,000 with increased insurance and the long-term costs of that offense.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, moving on to driver and vehicle services. Their mission is to provide fair, accurate, secure, and timely service through effective service options, accurate collection of data, fraud prevention, efficient collection of state revenue, and quality information and technical support for staff and business partners. Driver and Vehicle Services has an annual budget of approximately $55.6 million, with 534 employees working in 98 locations throughout the state. And they collect approximately $1 billion in state revenue. DVS is funded by special revenue by the Special Revenue Fund and the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. Driver and vehicle services include title and registration, auto dealer licensing and inspection, prorate services, driver exams, driver compliance, driver's license issuing, a public information center, operations support, and e-business options. I'm going to ask Director McCormick to join me at the table and provide any additional information that would be relevant and answer questions.
She's a frequent visitor. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Pat McCormick, the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services. And I think all of you did receive a report, our Minnesota Licensing and Registration System annual report, and I'll touch on that. But first, I wanted to just mention a few accomplishments that we had during this past year. Driver and Vehicle Services was able to finally meet the structured testing requirements for the Motor Carrier Safety Improvement Act, which was very important to all of us because that meant that we were able to not penalize the state for about $23 million in highway funding. And so we are now able to electronically message between states so that we're really enhancing the security of our commercial drivers, because that means that we are more quickly able to let another state know about the status of a driver, a commercial driver, and as you know, with the types of vehicles that they're driving and they drive across the states, it's very much a federal concern and a state concern to ensure that we have safe driver, all of our drivers are safe, but in terms of commercial vehicles, the accidents and fatalities can be even more serious. And so we are able to check quickly with other states as to the status of the driver, and to ensure that if they are not invalid status, that they're taken off the road as soon as possible. So we think that's a very important accomplishment. We still have some parts of that act that we need to complete, and our goal is to complete those by the end of September 2010. In addition to that, we are working on the National Motor Vehicle Information System in terms of coming into compliance. That is mandated federally through the U.S. Department of Justice. And as I think we've talked about it before, as you know, the goal of that is to ensure that consumers have the data they need for ensuring that that vehicle is safe, that it has not been damaged in some way that would be able to cause injury, as well as that we are also giving that information to law enforcement. Some states have seen record increases in the amount of thefts that have been prevented and the vehicle fraud cases that have been resolved because of the use of this data. And so we're getting ready to be able to load our data into that system. We've done some testing of it, and our goal is to have that completed by the end of March of this year as well. And also, we are working hard to try to ensure that we're meeting the goals of the MNLARS project, the licensing and registration system project we're working on. And obviously, we are very grateful for the support of the legislature and the governor in order to be able to collect that surcharge for these 4 years, so that we have the funding necessary to be able to implement that project. And we are on target in terms of the amount of revenue that we are collecting for the project. I think if you may not have the report in front of you, but I just wanted to mention a few things that were in the report. Obviously, right now we're interested in trying to meet the goals, and the goals for 2010 include finalizing our vision and looking at the detailed business processes that DVS will have in terms of streamlining and making it more efficient, hopefully serving our customers better, and also ensuring that the stakeholders that we interact with, there's something like 50 to 60 interfaces that we have with other stakeholder groups on a regular basis, and so those will all be part of this project, and we are working with stakeholders to ensure that we have their support, we're getting their feedback, we're ensuring that the process that we would do is something that they can support as well. So that's one of our goals, is to finalize that. We have been looking at our functional and non-functional requirements and defining the technical side, excuse me, the architecture that is needed for the system. And also, it's very important for us to also look at ways that we can improve our services and do that as part of the new system. And so we are hoping that we would be able to issue an RFP for the system vendor, the vendor that would actually build the system during this year, as well as to procure we'd issue an RFP, and we're also hoping that that selection process will take place during 2010. So those are major goals, and certainly they're daunting goals, but we believe we're on the right foot and we're moving forward, and we feel very fortunate that we have a lot of stakeholder involvement, including deputy registrars, driver's license agents, dealers, as well as various agencies that we interact with on a daily or monthly basis in order to ensure that we're providing the data that they are authorized to have to do their transactions as well. In this report as well, on page 6, we also talk about the annual revenues that were collected. And it was close to $1 billion this year. I think probably it was a little less than $1 billion because of the fact that there were not as many titles issued as normally would be, and some of that has to do with the auto business in general. But otherwise, we feel we've been on track. It's about 200,000 less titles than we would normally do. We usually do at 1.4 to 1.5 million, and we did 1.27 million. But otherwise, I think the rest of our statistics seem to be where they usually would be. So that's kind of what we are doing, kind of the status of what we are doing. I think that if probably any other questions you may have, I know that you wanted to hear a little bit about special plates, it sounded like, from the questions you were asking before. So I'm glad to answer any questions that you may have.
So the one question that I had, the state becomes a collection agency, and I think I've asked, does that pass through your department, or does it go directly to the group, whoever has that special plate? You know, the $10, some of them have 10 and 25. Is that handled through your operation then, or is that a separate check?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, there's a plate fee of $10 that for the special plates, and there's various fees depending on the plate. But if there's a contribution fee, those fees go to the agency that they are the contribution is being made. So that if it's critical habitat, then that money goes to the fund, the critical habitat fund with the Department of Natural Resources, or if it's support our troop plates, then that goes to the Veterans Affairs Department. If it's a college, then there's a Mr. Chair. If it's a college, there's a fund that or a donation that you have to give for collegiate plates, and that goes to the college.
It goes there, but are they directly the check made, or is it processed through your account or bookkeeping system? Do they write out two checks? Are you a collection agency? Is a question I'm asking.
Mr. Chair, I'll have to verify that. I know I'm most familiar with the Support Our Troops and the Critical Habitat, and that funding is it's through the state accounting system.
That's the state,
right?
Do we have any?
It's not just through us. It's through the whole state accounting system that would go to those two agencies. I'm not as familiar with what happens with the colleges, so I would need to get back to the committee to make sure I'm being accurate in my response.
Not the question I have, but we have requests for, again, this year for plates, and they aren't state agency, and that's a problem I have because they are maybe a nonprofit or something. We've had Vikings, we've had Special Olympics, we've had a lot of the charitable agencies, so they're not a state agency, and if you would ever have a special plate, and I don't know if we do have, I'd have to check again. That's what I was wondering, how that money's handled, because I don't think it's the state's business to be in a collection agency for those groups. That's the question I had. Representative Morgan, you had a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. McCormick, please, I think I understood what you're saying, but I just want to verify. Specifically, I had a constituent ask me about their Vietnam veterans plates. They pay an additional fee for that plate, but that fee is only when they need a plate, not every time they renew their tabs. Is that correct?
McCormick?
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes. Once you've paid, what I was talking about was the initial fee you pay when you apply for a special plate. Then some of them you may need to renew. You know, there are some plates that every 7 years you have to get a replacement, and that would be the only time you'd pay that fee for the plate. Every 7 years when you get your tab renewal form, it'll also include a plate charge, and then you need to get plates, or we will send out plates with your tabs if you mail it, or if you go to a deputy registrar office, they'll give you the plates when you renew your registration.
Representative Morgan.
Second question then, and just then let me verify, for those Vietnam vet plates, that additional fee above what I would perhaps pay for my regular plate, that additional fee goes to where?
Mr. Chair and Representative Morgan, that fee goes to DVS for the initial plate because it's more costly for us to produce those plates. And so we have a $10 charge for those plates because it's not the same as just doing the Minnesota, the regular passenger vehicle plates that we have. So that's just to pay for the additional costs for us making a special plate.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Morgan, too, I'm going to ask a question relating to that. The statutes provide that the department can only recoup the cost of making the plate, not for their administrative cost. And that's the question I always have. So basically, the metal and all that should be, and technically, you say your department picks it up, the administrative cost to some degree. But, I'll have the other, Representative Rutley had a question, too, before we get into that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. McCormick, I actually had a friend of mine who was recently renewing his, I believe it was his tabs, and he said that when he went to renew, he looked at the form and on the web-based version, if he renewed, he'd have to pay a fee, and it's an electronic renewal fee. And he said he looked at then the price of postage, compared it to the electronic renewal fee, and he just said kiddingly, it's cheaper for me just to send it in through the mail than it is to pay the additional fee. And it would seem to me that it would probably save administrative costs for these to be done electronically. So could you clarify whether or not it would be cheaper to do it electronically? And then if that's the case, then why are we putting on the internet that it's essentially going to cost them more to renew electronically than to send it in through postage? I'm just wondering why you just don't do away with that and just charge the amount that you need to.
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Representative Welty, well, as you know, I think what one of our missions is to try to find, to provide different service delivery avenues for our customers. And so we have the online, we have the mail, and then we have the face-to-face customer service. And the issue with the online system is that in order to have a secure online transaction, we have had to set our system up so that the information, when you go in to renew online, if any of you have, you'll notice first you go in and you just enter your VIN, part of your VIN number and your plate number, and then it takes you into the bank system. And the purpose for that is that so DVS does not get any personal financial data, and that's totally encrypted because there was concern that the way it could be if you entered all that information on the first screen, that during the transmission of the data it could have been taken while it was being electronically transmitted. And so we have to pay the bank for the costs associated with that secure transaction. And so we pay based on the number of transactions a month that we do, we pay a service fee to the bank. And so we have estimated in order to pay that service fee, because we don't get very many online transactions, only about 7% of our transactions are on our website. 20-some percent are through the mail, and the rest are all at deputy registrar offices. And so as a result, we have to charge that $1.75 just to pay for our costs, since we're a fee-based operation.
Further question? Would you explain the statute now pertaining to special plates?
Mr. Chair, you mean in
basically
terms of what the process is supposed to be? Or
if I'm coming in for it and I say to you I want a special plate, you have to have a bond or sell so many. We had that in statute. Could you explain that to the committee?
Yes. Mr. Chair, in 2003, we were looking at an efficient way that we might be able to standardize our special plate process. And so we looked at some other states in terms of what might be a best practice that some other states were using. And so we came up with what is in statute, and the statute number, I don't know if it's 168 5.1293. And in that statute, what we asked is that an organization that wanted a special plate would present a request to the commissioner, you know, and it would be based on a survey that would be done showing that there was interest in this special plate, and there would be a an application fee of $20,000. And that was basically just, it wasn't that we were going to necessarily keep that money, but the fee was proposed as a way to ensure that there really was the interest in the plate, and it would help us with the design and application for a new plate. And then if for some reason the plate didn't move forward, then $17,500 would be resubmitted to the organization that was wishing to move forward with the special plate. So in other words, if they couldn't get contributors that wanted the plate, then the money would be up to, most of the money would be refunded to that organization. That money that was the $2,500 would be money that would pay for the costs associated with the staff's work to develop the special plate design and work on trying to work out a marketing strategy with the with whatever the organization was.
That's still in statute.
It's still in statute, but there was a little bit in the statute. There is one section that does allow for the for having a statutory request approved by the legislature and the governor so that you could move forward with another special plate. And so that's why it's rarely, I don't think, well, we've never used it. So it's that we put it in there, but it's never been used. So,
okay. Representative Beard.
So if I'm understanding, Mr. Chair, then I can either bring my organization to you, say airplane pilots, and submit directly to you a check for $20,000 in a request, or I can find my local neighborhood legislator and have him draft a bill and kind of run around. Okay, I see how this works now. Yes. Just, oh, by the way, Mr. Chair, back to the fees for registration. So if I'm understanding, Ms. McCormick, then if I go on the website and renew the tabs for my pick-em-up truck, it's an additional $1.75 to pay for the transaction fee?
Mr. Chair and Representative Beard, yes, that's correct.
If I go over to my local deputy registrar and stand in line, I think I pay $4.50 or $5. Didn't we raise that? It's $4.50 in addition. If I mail it in, then I save either the $1.75 or the $4.50 then.
Mr. McCormick? Mr. Chair, you still, and Representative Beard, you still pay a filing fee.
The $4.50?
Mm-hmm.
Even though I'm not going to the deputy?
Mr. Chair, because we have to process them with our staff, so we need to pay for our costs associated with that process.
Good. I just wanted to be clear. Thank you.
Representative Beard, if you remember, they can't make any money on it, but they aren't supposed to lose anything either. They're supposed to recoup what they have. So basically, there should be some adjustment in, but it hasn't. So I've been bugging her all the time to see what it costs.
Yeah, sure.
And, of course, all of a sudden, she doesn't need any money, so I'm glad to hear that. Any further questions? If not, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. McCormick.
We just have two divisions left. The next one is administration and related services, and that really just includes the communications office, commissioner's office, human resources, fiscal and administrative services, and the office of technical and support services, and all those different functions really provide support to the various divisions that we have within the Department of Public Safety. And then the last division that we want to talk about is the Office of Pipeline Safety. Their mission is to protect lives, property, and the environment through the implementation of a program of gas and hazardous liquid pipeline inspections, enforcement, accident and incident investigations, and education. Their total budget per year is $2.25 million, and that comes from special revenue and federal funds. And of that money, $1.35 million per year is a direct appropriation from the special revenue derived from inspection fees and excavation damage prevention penalties.
And I have Fire Marshal Jerry Rosendahl with me, and he supervises both the Fire Marshal's Office and the Office of Pipeline Safety.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Jerry Rosendahl, State Fire Marshal and Director of Pipeline Safety. I provided a handout that basically updated, got the blue header on the top, that updated the information statistics from what we presented as an overview a year ago to this committee. And just to hit a couple highlights, and then I'll try to be brief. And what I'd like to do is give you just a brief overview on the house explosion and fire that occurred in St. Paul, and assure the committee that we are working aggressively and diligently to assure the public safety with regard to that situation. The Office of Pipeline Safety was created in 1987 following a major pipeline release that ignited in Moundsview. There's some interesting information, I think, in terms of the pipeline inspections. We're now over 70,000 miles of pipeline in Minnesota that we watch as it is being constructed or monitor over the years and do inspections for the pipeline companies. And I think a factor, kind of a trivia question, out of all of the energy that flows through those 70,000 miles of pipeline through Minnesota, less than 20% of that is actually used in Minnesota. We are a gateway, if you will, from Canada, Alaska, to the Midwest and to the South, and to our refineries here in Minnesota. There's several major pipeline projects that started last year in 2009, scheduled for completion in 2010, that really make up the additional miles. We also do, in addition to inspections, we also do the investigations. A couple of recent ones in 2007 in Clearbrook, Minnesota, the Enbridge explosion, where there were two fatalities. And then in Staples, just last year, the Koch oil pipeline, a leak, no fatalities or injuries. About 5,000 barrels of oil were had to be cleaned up. Both of those incidents were caused by errors that were made during repairs. Mm. It's not that the pipelines ruptured during just normal operation. During repairs, when they inspect these and find issues and they have to make repairs, that's where those particular ones.
Mr. Rosendahl, excuse me. Yeah. Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Rosendahl, the 70,000 miles, what does that include? How far down the pipeline tree do you go? The pipeline running down my street bringing natural gas to my house, are you in charge of those also, or mostly just the bigger transmission lines?
Mr. Rosendahl.
Mr. Chairman and members, that literally includes everything that are under that's reported to us by the pipeline operators, the utility companies that run through the areas too.
Everything, okay.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, if there are no questions specific to the operation, we'd like to just, in recognition of your time factor here too, just give you a brief overview on the house explosion and fire that occurred on Villard Avenue in St. Paul on Monday, February 1st, where a sewer contractor attempted to clear a clog in a sewer line with a cutting tool at this address. The contractor cut the natural gas line, a plastic line. As a result, the gas was released into the sewer and into the home. The gas ignited, injuring the contractor and causing a fire that destroyed the home. Thanks to the quick action of the person that was burned in getting himself and the homeowner out prior to the home going up, we averted an even worse disaster. Following that home explosion and fire on that injured one person, the Office of Pipeline Safety ordered Xcel Energy, whose gas pipeline this was, to find and fix any gas lines that have been inadvertently installed through sewer lines anywhere in Minnesota. We need to know how widespread this problem is in the state and how Xcel will address the issue to ensure the safety of the people of Minnesota. Our staff members are very closely monitoring the work that Xcel is doing to comply with our order. They have completed and complied with the first phase of the order, which was a deadline of yesterday to inspect 27 homes in that Villard Court area. They actually went beyond that into additional area neighborhoods and did another 32, as they reported to us. There are a number of other items in the order that essentially to provide us with all the information relating to the what is called trenchless excavation. And I might just comment on that, I guess not maybe well known to just everybody. When there's a new development go in, first thing that goes in typically in terms of utilities is a sewer, very, very deep, typically 7 to 8 feet deep. Gas lines, electric lines, phone lines, cable, and all those other things are typically much more shallow. The gas line is typically in the 3 foot to 30 inch area. So in a new development, new construction, you have such a separation there. This issue basically doesn't come up. When it comes up is when you move gas lines due to a number of reasons. In this case, this line was moved in 1991, and then this didn't happen until now. When they move that line and then they move it into the boulevard, the sidewalk is there, the shrubs are there, the trees are there, and the fence is there, and different things. So they don't want to dig up and open the trench up. So what is known as directional drilling or trenchless excavation, they actually are able to bore this through underground, and then they pull the gas line back through. This type of technology actually has been shown to occur now. We're seeing this where it'll actually penetrate, go through a sewer line, which is typically like a clay tile. So it goes through it, and in 1991, the technology for monitoring whether or not they hit anything as they were boring this through was not certainly as advanced as it is today. Today they can do listening devices and cameras and different things to do a better job of monitoring this. So that is why that happens. It's what's called a crossbore, where the sewer line comes down from the house out to the street this way, then the gas line's in the right-of-way and the sidewalk, and it's going this way. The only time this will happen is if the sewer line is higher than normal or the gas line is lower than normal, and then you have that situation.
Representative Horton had a question.
Yes.
When you're done with talking about the natural gas.
I'm sorry?
After you're done talking about the natural gas deal.
Mr. Chair, just a few more facts on this situation. There have been six leaks of this kind in Minnesota that we're aware of that where gas pipelines were found in sewers. Five of those in St. Paul, these were all XL gas pipelines, and one in Rochester. Not all of these resulted in an explosion, fire, or injury. Back in 2003, when this was found to be, and we got involved with seeing these six in cases, we did a number of things in terms of alerting other gas operators, the sewer contractors, people that clean out sewers and things like that. And that's a continuing and ongoing situation that the gas companies and sewer contractors continue to do. XL specifically back then in the period of 2003, 2004, and 2005 identified through surveying nearly 1,000 locations where there may be this situation, because they knew where they had done trenchless boring and moved gas lines. And in 2005, they actually reported to us all their findings. And on the last of three series of samples, they found none, and they had done. They basically felt they had done all the areas where there would be this risk and reported zero crossbore situations. So at that time, our particular file on this investigation was closed, and until this incident, we had not had any others that we are aware of occur in Minnesota. And I could provide details on those incidents, but I don't know that you necessarily need that. And I guess the closer on this is I just want to assure you, as we have been the public through media releases and postings on our websites and things, that this is a rare occurrence. Unfortunately, it carries with it a high risk. So, low frequency, high risk kind of a situation. We're taking aggressive action with Excel, and We've been talking with other gas companies and gas associations, actually, that are monitoring this, and we're certainly attempting to learn everything we can, and we want to make sure that all the known situations are corrected. And we've got a number of safety tips, if you will, for homeowners that we have on our website.
Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just two quick questions. One, the pipeline that burst, that spilled the 200,000 gallons of crude oil up in Staples or whatever goes through that pipeline. I'm assuming it's crude and it's not refined or anything. Who paid for your office's costs in dealing with that? Would that be the owner of the pipeline and the oil who paid all the expenses related to your operation, including the overhead related to that? And then with regard to these gas pipelines and the explosion and the time that you're having to put in, who's paying for the expenses for that?
Mr. Rosenthal.
Mr. Chair and members, we record any particular incidents like this, record all of our time to that particular incident so that it's not borne by the general utility.
So the owner of the pipeline pays?
Correct.
Representative Mason.
Mr. Chair, sir, just so that I have this clear, you normally do pipeline inspections, right? So would you somewhere along the line would have caught this had the accident not occurred? Is that what you're looking for?
Mr. Rosendahl.
Mr. Chair and members, since this is trenchless, the utility companies make every effort to make sure this doesn't happen as they put them in, but there's no visual inspection that can be done. What happens is you need to put a camera down the sewer. Cities can do this. The homeowner can hire somebody to do this, and that's what we recommend. If there's anybody that's got a concern about it, where a gas line's been moved and they want to know where their sewer is and where the gas line is, and they call for Gopher State One call and have everything located, and then we're aware that plumbers and people working in sewers have been very busy since last Monday, being called out by people where they want that camera down their sewer to scope this out. But that's the best method to determine that. The utility companies are the best ones to know where these potential situations are.
Any Representative Hortman?
My last question is your budget large enough for you to do the work that you need to do with regard to pipeline safety?
Mr. Chair and members, our budget is a large portion, 40% to 50%, is paid for by the Federal Office of Pipeline Safety, because we're under contract with them to do all of the interstate pipelines in Minnesota. That's a 40% to 50% of our budget. The remaining portion is billed out to the operators based on a per mile and a per meter basis. So there's no this is all special fund. There's no general fund money. And we are audited by the Federal Office of Pipeline Safety every year. They make recommendations in terms of staffing, and we're at adequate staffing.
Representative Hortman?
Yeah, I understand there's no general fund money. I just wondered if the fees are set high enough for you to do the work you need to do right now.
Mr. Chair, it's essentially divided up. The operational costs are essentially divided on a quarterly basis. We bill out the operators based on what our actual costs are. So, yes.
Mr. Rosendahl, do you have response teams like the, whatever you call it, a hazardous or hazmat? They only have two response teams in the state. Are you connected with them?
Mr. Chair and members, we do not have response teams, if you will. We would utilize the state's chemical assessment teams, hazardous materials teams, or local responders to handle that portion of it. Our staff, obviously, our personal protective safety equipment, and they're trained in everything from the incident command system to the hazardous materials, operational kind of requirements. But no, we're not a go team from a response standpoint. We're a go team for the investigation and then mitigation afterwards.
So the first responder, like at Clearbrook or Staples, that would have been the hazmat team. That's out of Moorhead then.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm not probably. The Clearbrook Fire Department works all the time I've talked with the fire chief there, they had just completed a drill there a week or a month or two prior to that incident. They know the facility very well, get along very well with them, and have certain capabilities, but no, they have to, on a situation like that, they'll ratchet it up very quickly, call the state duty officer, and get additional resources in.
Do you have to then, do they get any funding from you, the local department?
Mr. Chair, that we do not fund the response teams.
Any further questions? Does that complete your testimony, Mr. Rosendahl?
Mr. Chairman, that is my story.
Look at how nice you did. Or have done, I mean, not did.
Thank you.
Well, if there are no Representative Hornstein, you have a question?
No, I'm just thinking about the pipeline safety.
You were thanking somebody.
Yeah, no.
Does that complete your testimony, Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, yes, it does.
Representative Hortman.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, just one more question, and it's about money again. Your agency gets $15 million in general fund money. I'm wondering if you got a cut target from the governor, and if you know what is going to be cut, if anything, from your agency.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hortman, no, I have not gotten that information at this point.
Representative Hortman, I guess the fiscal chairs are looking at each responsibility, and our fiscal analyst is providing some data, or data, whatever you want to call it. If there are no further questions.
Just before we cut them, I always like to know where they think they should be cut to.
Right. So I think the commissioner recognizes they may have to share some pain. Is that what you're saying? And maybe if you didn't, Commissioner, you may have to share some pain. And
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we're very aware that we may have to share some pain. I just don't have the details at this point.
Yeah. Well, no further questions. Thank you very much for all your participants, too. We have a meeting again next Tuesday, so it's posted on the agenda, on the web. No further questions. The meeting's adjourned.